Hi, I'm David Manti, and welcome to a new episode of the Today in Manufacturing podcast. With me this week is Andy Zoll and Anna Wells. We each have more than 15 years of experience covering the manufacturing industry. Every week, we take the five most popular stories on our websites and discuss the implications they have on the industry going forward. Before we get started, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You can also help us out a lot by leaving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use. If you want to email the podcast, you can reach any of us at Andy, David, or Anna at IN.com with email the podcast in the subject line. You can also like us on YouTube at IN Magazine so you can catch us when we go live every Thursday. At some point, because right before we were about to start, we found out that we had a technical difficulty that was best described as "you're not going to understand." So I appreciate that. But Andy, how you doing this week? It's good to see you again.
Yeah, it's been a little while. It's good to be back.
True. Like, have you been back on the podcast since your grand adventure overseas?
I don't think so.
Yeah?
Has it
changed you fundamentally as a person?
Do you have an accent now?
I feel like every time, and when I say every time, I mean like twice in my life, you go over to the British Isles. By the end of the trip, you're like, oh, I could do that accent. It's passable. And then 12 hours after you land, you're back to your Hoser, Wisconsin accent, which is fine. I liked the public transit over there.
Oh, yeah.
Public transit guy. But no, it was good. We had fun.
It's good to go and see that it is possible and really easy to use. If executed right.
If only.
Anna, how are you doing this week?
Good. I was in San Antonio this week, which is equally exotic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As London.
You have the beautiful Riverwalk.
That's true. Yeah.
It's probably more exotic than London. Let's be very honest. Like,
well, I've done nothing and gone nowhere. So let's.
All right.
Let's do a read from our sponsor this week, which is Oracle NetSuite. One of the long-lasting impacts of COVID-19 and the global pandemic it created has been the priority now being placed on long-term enterprise-wide planning. You can join me and Jeff Franke as we discuss Oracle NetSuite's latest white paper, The Ultimate Guide to Scenario Planning. You'll be able to hear about the new strategies and steps that you can use to help de-risk your organization. So if you want to register for that, click the link in the live chat or in the body below. Our first story this week, Pfizer to cut $3.5 billion in costs and close a New Jersey plant. Pfizer was a COVID vaccine and booster pioneer, but now the company has to make some tough decisions after, quote, the world moved on. At one point, vaccines and boosters were seen as a possible get out of quarantine free card. Well, 3 years after the pandemic panic and 2 years into mass vaccinations, things have stabilized. The New York-based company has confirmed that it will close its PPAC New Jersey facility in 2024. Initial reports put the layoffs near 800, but Pfizer says those numbers are unfounded. The company says it simply hasn't landed on a number yet because the vast majority of PPAC's workers could be relocated to a New York plant. Pfizer also had layoffs in Illinois and Colorado and two more closures in North Carolina. COVID products aside, the company's recent revenue reports showed a 10% gain. Anna, is this more COVID scapegoating or is it just still adjusting to the new normal?
Yeah, I think so. You know, obviously this is a very unique situation that Pfizer is dealing with compared to some of the other fallout from, I would say, COVID-related overproduction. Mm-hmm. So this has been kind of crazy for the company. They reported that the decline in COVID-related products alone had pushed Pfizer to its first quarterly loss since 2019. And to me, it looks like Pfizer's biggest sin here was probably just not recalibrating soon enough.
Right.
You sort of can't blame them for that since there was such a prolonged period where society, I think, viewed it as, you know, they looked to companies like Pfizer and Moderna and almost viewed it as their responsibility to just pump out as much of this vaccine, these antivirals as they possibly could.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the scale of that phenomenon was unusual. But in pharma, what's not unusual is going down a path that you have to abandon at some point. Right, I mean, that kind of happens a lot, right? There's regulatory hurdles. You see pharma companies pump a ton of money into categories or products that never get approved, or they get taken off the market, just things that they ultimately have to walk away from. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of hedged against that as a business model in pharmaceuticals, especially large pharmaceutical companies. Pfizer has a lot of irons in the fire. They have an RSV vaccine that's hitting the market now. Mm-hmm. They are in development on an obesity treatment product that is set to compete in what's considered now the fastest growing market in the pharmaceutical industry. So outside of all this, I think the biggest thing that led to Pfizer's course revision, I guess, is the fact that they agreed to take back 8 million Paxlovid treatment courses that were purchased by the U.S. government.
Oh, wow.
Which resulted in Pfizer slashing $9 billion from its sales forecast. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what that contract looked like. Maybe some language in there that accounted for this exact scenario, or maybe it was just a lot of pressure to take that back. Just because it was such a big spend. It made me think, like, you kind of wonder what other industry you would see something like that. Like you know, you buy 3 warplanes and then you decide you don't need them. And then you got to pressure Northrop Grumman to take them back.
Hey, we don't need these and we kind of need the money back.
Sorry, we need the money. We are not going to pay you for these. So
that was part of the crazy swing, right? Is that it was like, it went from being like $9.1 billion in profit to like just $630 million or something like that? Or wait, no, that's a different story.
Yeah, I don't know the exact numbers there, but I do know that Pfizer was only in the red because of their COVID products. Like the rest of their products that they were putting out, I think they showed like a 10% gain was what Forbes had said overall, but then that was just such a drag on their overall profitability, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I did have that wrong. Those were stats from a subsequent story. Andy, it's an interesting idea, this like recalibrating soon enough, because I feel like Anna kind of talked about how in pharmaceutical, they're sort of like, they already have that kind of baked in.
Yeah.
And so even though COVID is just another instance that they've had to recalibrate from, it made me think that there are a lot of other industries and companies that don't have that kind of cooked in and don't know how to do it. And we're still kind of seeing some fallout.
Yeah. There was a lot of that with COVID, just not even in the pharmaceutical industry, just other companies that were churning out, you know, PPE just to kind of pitch in. And then they had to, you know, the demand for that waned, and then they have to either shutter those plants if they're in that market, or, you know, go back to what they were doing before that. So you'd have to assume there was some sort of, that Pfizer assumed that there would be some sort of boom and bust cycle with this, given that the crush of demand was so high, mm-hmm. and that it would even out over time. But they even projected before this year's, with the updated shots, they projected a 24% COVID vaccination rate this year. So whether that's due to just, you know, consumer fatigue or due to persistent vaccine misinformation, it's been still a struggle to get kind of this mass vaccination campaign after 3 years. It's been 3 years of this. So
is that overall only 20%, or is that like now only 20% are keeping up?
Do believe.
Yeah, getting the new correct. The new updated
one with the variants. And one thing I thought was interesting in that story that I read, I believe it was Reuters, but public health officials are particularly worried about infants and small children, because mm-hmm. most people at this point have been exposed to it. They've either had it, they've had the shot, both. But children after 6 months, they're probably not protected, more than likely, and they're eligible to get this. So I don't know that, I'm sure they factored in some sort of evening out of that demand, but maybe not to this degree.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I know that I was vaccine averse until I had kids. And then they're just like, all they had to say was like, if you don't get this, you could get your kid like deathly ill. And I'm like, put it in me. Mm-hmm. Like, what do you need? And I wish more people thought that way. I mean, what did we run a? We ran a story this week about how an insane number of kids have syphilis nowadays.
Yeah.
Like, hey, let's stop going backwards.
You shouldn't get vaccinated to help Pfizer. You should get it to, you know, help yourself and your kids and your family.
This is for Pfizer.
Humankind.
Yeah. I'm not saying, we are not saying that.
Just like, I will only get it if I have, if the Band-Aid says pro Pfizer.
Yeah. How do we keep the facility open? I'll get it four times. What do I need to do?
Well, so a lot was said about what's going to happen to these jobs. And they said that they could go to this New York shop. So I wanted to look that up. The plant in New York is about an hour away from the plant and 2 hours by train. So it's not just like that all of a sudden becomes an easy shift, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, I get it. If you want to keep your job at Pfizer, that's something that you're got to be willing to put in the time and do. But that's going to have to be that'll be a real logistical challenge for some people. Mm-hmm. They did note that a few of the jobs would go to Parsippany, which is less than 30 minutes away. So while it was a few, at least it'll be a little bit more feasible for people. And, you know, I kind of mentioned it before talking about COVID fallout. That's kind of to be continued just in this episode alone, because I think that we're going to talk about that again. And I'm kind of curious if we're like fully in the new normal yet from COVID. Do you think we are, Andy?
It doesn't seem that way.
Yeah.
But maybe, you know, you kind of assume when a virus becomes endemic that you stop taking all these precautions like we did with the flu and that sort of thing. And we're still doing that to some degree. So I don't know if maybe that is the new normal part of it, that like, hey, if you test positive, you know, sit out of work for a week. But it doesn't feel like it, but maybe we are.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess I'm thinking of the new normal just in terms of like, you know, companies still don't quite are still like kind of walking on eggshells, I feel like, or not, like trying to figure out the best path forward in terms of like de-risking their business for a potential life-changing event like that. And we're still seeing fallout from the last one. All right. Well, our next most popular story this week, Tesla may soon build a much more affordable EV. A recent Reuters report says Tesla is planning production for a 25,000 euro electric vehicle at its factory near Berlin. That's less than $27,000, much lower than the current average of 65,000 euros. In the U.S., Americans are paying around $53,000 for new EVs. It looks like Tesla's investments in gigacasting are paying off. The company has been designing massive presses for forming large sections of its vehicle's underbodies. The technology could vastly reduce the number of individual parts needed to assemble a vehicle and consequently reduce the time and cost associated with production. All of this should theoretically result in lower prices for consumers. But at the end of the day, Andy, is that going to happen?
It will, if it works. So that kind of remains to be seen. So Tesla is already doing giga casting. They're calling it these, you know, casting of large parts for the fronts and the rears of their Model E, I believe it is. Mm. What Model Y? They don't have a Model E.
Oh, that's right. The Model 3.
Yes.
Yeah.
But what they're talking about doing now is almost the complete underside of the vehicle. So you're talking about hundreds of components and basically cutting that down to one.
Yeah.
So it's not rocket science that doing that would make the production process cheaper and more efficient. And the reason other companies haven't done it is because it's very expensive to build those kinds of presses. And if you need to do something to change them, that's even more expensive. So there's a lot of risk involved.
Right.
But if they can do it without those sorts of headaches, which they've done with gigacasting, but there's also been a lot of headaches in Tesla's history.
Mm-hmm.
Then it'll do more than just make them a budget electric vehicle. It'll make the entire auto industry have to catch up, basically.
Yeah.
So this is a very intriguing, remains to be seen, I think.
Yeah. And Anna, we've kind of seen this shift away from the budget vehicle, the economic vehicle. I mean, that's why I'm curious about it, right? Because I see people investing in gigacasting because it cuts a lot of cost out of the process. And there is a new bar set in terms of what people are paying for a car, right?
Mm-hmm.
So do you think that Tesla could go back to like a $25,000 EV, you know, almost more than cutting the average price of an EV in half right now?
I do have some concerns about Tesla. And if this is a strategy of going for these super low point of entry vehicles, we talked about this recently on the podcast about their price cuts. At that time, we also talked about some very real variables that are going to be challenging for Tesla going forward, especially as they try to cut costs and become this really low entry point for EVs. Market competition, which is heating up like crazy, and with just margin erosion in general, that they're going to deal with, and that's coming with their race to the bottom on price. This is a strategy to me that carries a lot of risk. And in this case, it seems like they're maybe doing a little bit more of the same, which has me concerned. I don't think Tesla has reached a point of scale where they've streamlined their operations enough to both sell at high volume and in scale in a way that can fulfill the orders that they need to fulfill in order to make this work.
To turn a profit.
Yeah, I mean, I just at some point you cut too close to the bone, and you can't afford to make mistakes. And to Andy's point, like, reworking this casting is incredibly expensive. Mm-hmm. We've seen Tesla roll out new production strategies before they're ready, and have a ton of problems with them, a ton of quality problems, really slow output. Those are not affordable for Tesla right now. Those are like delays that they can't afford to have right now. It's clear that Elon Musk is trying to target a new market with his EVs. We know he alienated some of his core customers with some of the things he said and did. And so I think he's making a play for a sort of underserved segment, which is this entry-level EV buyer.
Yeah.
The cheaper EV. It makes sense on paper to me, but at the same time, it's not something that you can do for very long.
Yeah. And I mean, it's a very enticing price point. You hear $25,000 EV and it's like a no-brainer.
You'd right. have to think that people would be, who are right now in the used market, could be talked into buying new at that price point if it's an electric. You have to think that.
I totally agree. And, you know, maybe it provides a much needed boost for getting people in the door on EVs. But at the same time, if you look at their competition, so it took Tesla, 10, 12 years in order to turn a profit. They had a really slow go of it getting off the ground. Now they are to a point where they're pretty steady and they're scaled effectively and they have a lead. But GM and Ford are already car makers. They already know how to build cars. So for them, that is not, there's no way that that takes as long. Mm-hmm. For them to get up to speed, they're going to get to price parity much faster. And so I think this is a very short window that he has to be in this pocket before they're going to come for him.
Yeah.
And I don't know what happens then.
But I think the time is now if he's going to go for it. Because, Tesla wants to sell 20 million vehicles by 2030. We've heard that number thrown around. A $25,000 EV is going to help him hit that mark. But I don't know that Tesla can do that and make money.
Well,
to
that's, your point. That's the thing. Like, at a loss. So what's the point of that?
But if they figure out gigacasting, it's one of those where they saw the future way before everybody. And like Toyota, I think, is the closest. And they're a third of the way. And it's still a prototype. You know, we've done the story on how Toyota is betting on gigacasting. The prototype I mentioned is building a third of a car in 3 minutes. We mentioned that. But again, it's still the prototype stage. And Tesla right now, they pioneered the technology. And as Toyota's catching up, they seem to be further ahead. Volvo just bought two new 9,000-ton gigapresses. And with Toyota's prototype, Tesla has one that could die-cast the entire underbody of an EV in one piece. So while Toyota's working on a third of a car, Volvo's just starting with the technology. If Tesla can get it right to the point where they're doing the entire underbody of an EV in one piece, I think that could be a real difference maker if they could scale it.
It could, but they have made so many mistakes from an operational standpoint. Tesla did not start as a manufacturing company. These other companies are manufacturers. They've been doing it for many, many years. So I do think that, again, being first to market is valuable for as long as you're there. And then as soon as people catch up to you, you lose a lot of that value. So I just don't think they have that much time.
Yeah, it's a grow with me sort of promise that they're looking for. Just like, hey, listen, all right, you're coming in at 25. It's a brand new prototype. There are going to be some bugs. Reassure you, it's going to be less than $28,000 worth of bugs.
Right. And also, like, they made a pretty enticing promise on the Cybertruck recently about what that was going to cost when they unveiled that buddy in 2019. It's still not available. And it's they're going to charge people like double now.
And it makes you think, if they didn't go so far in on the Cybertruck or Optimus, would this already be here?
Maybe.
You know, if, you know, Musk didn't have like internal splinter cells trying to make a cyberpunk truck and a humanoid worker, maybe we'd already be there.
Maybe.
One thing that, I mean, as this gigacasting becomes more and more, I'm intrigued because I feel like one day we're going to be stamping houses.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, the technology itself is exciting, and I do think there's a future there. I mean, you look at what 3D printing can do now compared to when that first people started to dabble in that, and there was a lot of skepticism, and now it's like a completely different world.
Yeah, and because it was a joke, just like, man, what if we could make a machine that could print a whole house? And then somebody's just like, I think you could make a machine that could print a whole house.
Yeah.
And so I'm interested to see what's to come, but issues of repairability and scrap are and recyclability will be huge just because the fewer parts we're using, the harder it's going to be to repair. And I don't know, like everyone who's got a metal stamped house is going to need to learn how to weld for when she cracks. I don't know. Just a lot of caulk. All right. Well, our next most popular story, which has the stats I erroneously used in the first story, but we're working through it. Shipping giant Maersk to slash 10,000 jobs. Maersk is the biggest shipping company in the world. Last Friday, the company sent shockwaves through the industry when it announced plans to cut 10,000 jobs due to, quote, challenging market conditions resulting in substantially lower freight rates compared to the abnormally high rates in 2022. The cuts will save Maersk $600 million in 2024. Am I saying that right? Because at Maersk...
Maersk.
It's Maersk, right? Maersk? Is it Maersk? All right, I think I confirmed that it was Maersk. The company, Maersk, which is based in Copenhagen, said it listed profits before taxes at $691 million last quarter, down from $9.1 billion for the same period last year. Company CEO Vincent Clerc said the industry is, quote, facing a new normal with subdued demand. Prices back in line with historical levels and inflationary pressure on our cost base. The company's Q3 revenue was $12.1 billion in 2023. Anna, it was $22.8 billion for the same period in 2022. And this is what I was trying to sort of like hint at with the first story, just in terms of these crazy surpluses that are now coming back, still coming back down to a new normal, and like Maersk just having to make some big adjustments as a result.
I know. I mean, there was definitely a time there during the latter half of the pandemic still that people were thinking like, this is going to be the way it is now. And
we're not going to get any shipping containers ever. And when we do, they're going to be incredibly expensive.
Yeah, the supply chain's backed up forever. And people are going to spend and spend and spend. And we're seeing that that is not true at this point. It definitely, I think this situation, 10,000 is a huge, shocking number. So I can see why people are interested in this story. I think it speaks to what's we're going to see likely more of. And that is logistics companies kind of like righting the ship a little bit, no pun intended, but cutting back in response to these conditions that are impacting their industry. You know, experts believe that higher inventories and reduction in consumer spending are going to persist in the coming year. And this is going to be, paired with a business model for carriers that's really asset heavy, you know, people who are either owning or renting over the road trucks, ships, intermodal, like trains. It's just it. And then you add to that the high cost of wages, you know, people sitting on big piles of stuff already. And they're already anticipating holiday sales are going to be lower this year. So there's a lot. It's a lot of perfect storm going into this. And so painful decisions are being made, I guess. And even industry insiders like looking forward, they're saying, you know, we anticipate that there will be some softness in consumer spending in early 24. We anticipate there will be some price cuts to try to entice buyers. Yeah. And so we may see a bump in the second half. But they don't believe that's going to be enough on its own to stave off future cost-cutting measures by these companies. So CNBC ran a report on this a week or two ago where they got some new data on what what folks in the industry were expecting of the supply chain in 2024. They quoted Paul Brashear, the vice president of drayage and intermodal at ITS Logistics, who said, quote, "Unfortunately, we're going to see significant challenges in volumes, and this will continue to cause more providers to exit the market or implement significant layoffs. This is not 2008 and 2009 by any means, but it sure feels like it." That was his quote.
Sorry, I had to look up drayage because I thought you said he was the VP of drainage. I'm like, that's not right.
Drainage, no.
Yeah, which is a form of trucking service that when you're using two different types of shipping, intermodal shipping, so ocean freight and air freight. I don't know. Fun fact for myself anyways.
Yeah, write it down.
I will. I'm bookmarking it right now.
Did you get the quote though? Or were you busy?
No, I was actually kind of busy. What was the quote?
It was a good quote. He said, "Unfortunately, we're going to see significant challenges in volumes, and this will continue to cause more providers to exit the market or implement significant layoffs. This is not 2008 and 2009 by any means, but it sure feels like it."
Well, you're right. That is a great quote. And it tees me up for what I was interested in. And is, do you think this workforce comes back? Just because we've seen incredible advancements when it comes to a lot of automation and autonomy, particularly in this industry. Do you think the rebound happens and brings the workforce back? Or do you think that these jobs might be gone for good?
I have no way of answering that question, but
I just kind of pick one and go with it.
I do, you know, I heard an economist speak this week who had some really interesting things to say about the job market. And basically he said, you know, people ask me all the time, when are we going to go back to normal? Mm-hmm. When is the job market going to go back to normal? And he said, the answer is never. and that's because the demographic shift has happened in the last couple of years, kind of in tandem with COVID, but it happened nonetheless, to the point where like we don't have enough workers to service all of the economy is growing faster than we can produce people mm-hmm. to tend to it, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know if these jobs are coming back, but I don't know if it's good if all the jobs come back. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, because I think that there is a point where they need to figure out how to automate their way out of it or how to streamline their way out of it or whatever that is, because there isn't a way of doing all of this with people.
No, it is. It's, and I know that it's a common thread that I'm just like clinging to desperately for this episode. But when we're talking about like navigating what the new normal is, mm-hmm. like, I think that we still don't know at all. And things are still changing so rapidly. I don't know that it seems messy just because we're kind of at a lot of inflection points when it came to a lack of skills, a lack of workers, and the influx of technology that's actually, you know, starting to work as it was predicted. And I think there are just incredible changes still coming.
For sure.
Andy, when you were looking, you know, you cover the supply chain every day very heavily. When you saw these cuts coming out of Maersk, what were your initial thoughts?
Well, that's a big number. Probably like most people who read the story, that's a big, large, round number that they're throwing around, 10,000 people.
Yeah.
You know, everyone knows it's been rocky across the shipping sector over the past few years, and we've already, you know, thrown a bunch of numbers around in this story so far. But just to take it back a little bit, Maersk in 2021 reported $62 billion in revenue, and last year that went up to $82 billion. And that was a new record, but instead of, you know, they highlighted the record, but they also, even at that point, knew that things were changing. Inflation was happening, there were steps being taken to prevent it, people were reassessing their inventories, and they knew that this year was not going to be good. So it's an interesting story just because of the volume of jobs we're talking about. Usually when we're talking about layoffs, you know, it's hundreds.
Yes. Not tens of thousands.
Correct. It's just such a, and it's a huge company, but it's still just a mind-boggling number. So that's really all that is. And it's just kind of maybe the clearest example of how fast things can change in industry overall, but especially in this industry.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the numbers were a little shaky for me too, because they said they're going to cut 10,000, but then when you looked into it, they've already cut 6,500 this year, and now it's going to be another 2,500. And talking about their workforce, Andy, they're still at, with the cuts, with the, I think 10,000, that's going to put their workforce at 103,500.
It's the scale that where like a lot of these, you feel like automakers mention this a lot, like we're going to reduce the workforce, but we'll be able to do it through attrition and retirements, that sort of thing. They won't have to actually lay people off. It feels like it's such a large company that, you know, maybe they can do some of that. Like it's the scale of the 10,000 here is not as big as it would be, you know, in another company.
True. Well, and
although they explicitly said layoffs, true. I do believe. So, well, you know, I mean, never mind.
But I mean, they also said that it's going to continue to, like they said, they're going to continue to shrink their global workforce by another 10% to fewer than 100,000 positions. So I guess
they did say cut 10,000 jobs. So that could be attrition, what have you, I think, in theory.
Okay. Okay. So
so maybe more is what you're saying. You want to get under 100,000 and they're not there yet.
No. Oh, so that's what I was saying. Yes. Is that they said these cuts are happening now, but we want to get under 100,000. So there's going to be at least 3,501 more coming, if not more. So kind of keep a lookout for that. All right. Well, our next most popular story this week, good old fashioned caper.
Yes, a heist.
Failed U.S. Mint dime heist lands thieves in hot water. On April 13th, a truck carrying $750,000 in dimes from the U.S. Mint in Philadelphia was on its way to Miami when the driver pulled into a parking lot to get some rest. That's about 6 tons of dimes in that truck. Under the cloak of night, thieves made off with a portion of its cargo, stealing more than 2 million dimes and leaving thousands of coins scattered all over the lot. The theft, which totaled about $234,500, was part of a crime spree targeting tractor trailers passing through the area. Other heists lifted frozen crab legs, shrimp, meat, beer, and liquor. According to the indictment that was unsealed on Friday, after the theft, thousands of dimes were converted into cash at coin machines in Maryland and through deposits at least 4 different suburban Philadelphia banks. 4 Philadelphia men face conspiracy, robbery, theft, and theft of government money and other charges. Man, Andy, I just think that they were really okay until they made off with the dimes.
Have you guys seen Blazing Saddles?
Yeah.
All I can think of when I see this headline is that throwaway line when they're at the toll booth in that movie.
I don't remember the line.
All right, well, I'll send it to you later. This is a family podcast.
Okay.
So, I mean, I almost have to hand it, you know, like you said, they were okay right up until, yes.
Yeah, like, I mean, they're trying to move frozen crab legs, shrimp, meat, beer. I mean, right now it's just a really great holiday party. And then all of a sudden they stumble onto like 6 tons of dimes.
The normal reaction.
Or federal.
The normal reaction to seeing any great amount of small coins should be like not worth it. Right?
Yeah.
Not worth it?
I mean, I think at first you're giddy. Like, that was one of the things I took away was they probably opened this up and they're like, we are rich beyond all belief.
So they made off with, I just did some mental math here, but let's say if it's 6 tons of dimes and they made off with 234 out of 750, you know, that's a little shy of 2 tons, I think, if I'm doing my math right there.
Dimes.
So they loaded up 2 tons of dimes and got away with it, which is, well, temporarily got away with it. A couple things here. I have to imagine stealing directly from the mint makes things easy to trace.
Yeah.
I don't know how hard people are tracing dimes, but
yeah, we're looking for the really shiny ones.
Yeah. And I looked at, what did they say? Coinstar they went to?
It was
coin machines.
A coin machine.
So
yeah.
I just went to Coinstar because that was the one I thought of. And they say on their website, if you have more than $3,000 in coins, let us know. We can probably help you out. So let's say, taking that as a limit, I actually did real math on this with my computer calculator. That's 78 trips to the Coinstar.
I mean,
that's just too much patience. And they clearly weren't even patient enough.
No. Well, and they also deposited at like local banks.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they weren't. I mean, come on. They're not the most savvy.
This probably wasn't thought through properly beforehand.
You deposit it at the bank?
Yeah, just like,
why?
Time to finally get rid of that dime collection.
Got all this cash, probably should put this on paper.
The move here, I think, is to, when you have a lot of silver, you just bury it and mark it with an X.
You know how to execute a heist.
There you go.
Yeah, I think they would have been best served had they done that because, Anna, I can't imagine that it took a lot of investigative work other than a few phone calls like, hey, You see any big dime deposits lately?
Yeah. Do you see any of these dimes that haven't hit the market at all yet?
Yeah. Just, I don't know. We're looking for like 3 to 4 nefarious types with bags of dimes.
Tons.
Pillowcases full of dimes.
Sacks with dollar signs on them full of dimes.
And then they're like, oh, yeah, they're still in town here.
You know what? We were just talking about that at lunch. It was crazy.
Yeah. There's a bank next door to this parking lot, and they're here. This is like, the story is like sort of hilarious, but you know, you have to look at the downside of this, not just for these thieves who are in hot water, i.e. prison.
Yeah, like, well, that's what I was saying, you know, up until then they're just stealing food and drink. You know, you start stealing $230,000 worth of money and you're looking at like, I think it was like the, it
from,
starts at 10.
Directly from the mint.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think it starts at 10 years minimum. So, yeah, they're going to have some time to think about their poor choices.
For sure. But, you know, they weren't doing good stuff either. So, obviously, this sounds like a crime of opportunity. They were breaking into whatever random trailers that they could find and taking the contents. They didn't know what they were getting. Mm-hmm. I don't think that the law is too light on that either.
Yeah.
You know, that's interstate commerce. That's probably a federal crime to begin with. So not a good start for these guys. But to me, it was hard to not think about how scary a scenario this is also for trucking companies to kind of look at how this went down and what it means for them. Because all I can think of is, okay, so it was very random. You have this driver who is probably taking a mandated sleeping break. You know, mm-hmm. That's legally required to take a certain number of hours off. So this driver is setting up for the night and thieves are just cutting open trucks. He's probably in a spot where he feels safe because they all, you know.
I feel like he was in like a gated area. Like I thought that he wasn't just at like a run of the mill rest stop, but I could be wrong.
Well, and even at those rest stops, I think, you know, the truckers who have been doing this, they would feel safe generally there because that's where everybody is, you know, they're well lit. So as a trucking company, to see how easy it was for a trailer to be ransacked while the driver is unaware, clearly because they got away with so much stuff, there's no way that he really woke up and was coming around to the back, or maybe he was afraid. I don't know. Mm-hmm. You could see that. But you really have to look at now going forward how this can be prevented, because they used bolt cutters. That's what was described as the way they got in, bolt cutters. So, you know, how much money now do you need to apply to this problem? Sensors, you need security devices, all that costs money. This is a mint truck, so, you know, something's not, you know, not enough is being done, obviously, to keep this safe if it can be cut into with just a general bolt cutters.
Right. They save the good trucks for the quarters.
They must, or the dollars, yeah.
I mean, do they even pay attention? Just like, what's in there? Dimes, put a padlock.
Yeah, well, you should see the penny truck. So secondly, I think for the driver, you know, we know that long-haul trucking is notoriously tough to staff.
Right.
The hours are really long, you know, you're on the road for a long time, people go in for the money, but they don't last very long. The turnover rate is incredibly high within the first year. And so to me, this is just adding to that whole like what if potential scenario that people are looking at or thinking about when they you know, this company or these industries are trying to find workers, and now you have to think about, well, am I safe on the road, am I safe at night, am I going to get jacked in the middle of the night for my cargo, is it worth it to do this job? I just think the trucking industry certainly doesn't need this kind of publicity ever.
No, they already have so many barriers to entry for their stat or workers. Mm-hmm. And this is just another, you know, thing that could keep people away.
For sure.
I got to go back to, I feel like at some point they opened those doors and they just thought they hit a gold mine or like a silver mine, you know, like, and think of like the backbreaking work that it takes to physically haul $200,000+ in dimes into a getaway car. Just like, I mean, we got essentially like a sock full of pennies from my grandpa because he used to collect pennies. It was like a legit like bank bag full of it. And it was incredibly heavy. So incredibly heavy. So I couldn't imagine what it was like shoveling these and then like, you know, just the logistics of getting them from A to B.
How low do you think that car was riding on the way
up? Pretty low. Sitting pretty low. Like, as they're, like, trying to check the traffic cameras to see which one.
Sparks flying off.
Check that one. I also wonder, is this going to be the one that got away for the thieves? Because I just see them, you know, kind of sitting for an extended period of time and being able to reflect and just like, man, imagine if we knew there were dimes and imagine if we had the logistics to get them all, you know?
Oh, like how could we have done this better?
Or what could have been, you know, like $750,000? Like,
if we had a hookup who knew how to launder dimes?
Yeah. And like, what do you actually expect in a return on like a $750,000 dime fence? You know, like.
Did they say what kind of car they were driving?
I don't know if producer Eric wants to know if they said what kind of car they were driving, and I didn't catch it. Okay. But it would be interesting to see because I don't imagine.
Toyota Corolla.
Yeah, it's a Corolla or a Yaris, just with 3 tons of or 2 tons of dimes. It also brought me back to last week, right? So, and you're in case you missed it, Anna, because it just put a little bit more context on the 3 tons of likely pennies now that JMF Enterprises tried to pay its settlement mm-hmm. with. Because that is just, it gives you a better understanding of the scale and just how ridiculous that must have been. And did we talk about how he made a custom made metal box containing these coins?
I saw that in the story. I don't know if we talked about it on the podcast.
And it was just, so, you know, he's a JMF Enterprises was trying, as he's delivering these coins to the lawyers for Fired Up Fabrications. They delivered 3 tons of pennies, about what, $23,500 worth of pennies in a custom made metal box. And I'm sorry, the story just gets better. It just gets better. And it was like, and they actually got really upset because it wound up being too heavy to be carried in the freight elevator at the offices. And, you know, it couldn't even be carried by like the forklift. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just like, I just see this guy, you know, welding together this metal box, which probably you couldn't even open. I bet he welded the pennies completely in this metal box, so it was unopenable. And just like, here's your payment. But that is just a story that keeps on giving. And if you haven't taken the opportunity last week to check it out, just get into it because spite is powerful.
It sure is.
So powerful.
And funny.
Yeah, it just makes people so creative. All right. Well, if you're going to jack a truck, make sure there's at least quarters in there. All right. Our most popular story this week, weapon designed to avoid headshots. The new Smart Protector 303T from weapons maker FN Herstal, or Herstal, has been sold as a less lethal option for law enforcement that they can use on crowd control, riots, and day-to-day patrols. The company says it's designed to be accurate enough to single out individuals, and it shoots projectiles that break up on impact and deliver a, quote, highly dissuasive impact similar to a baton strike. It hurts. The 303T is notable because it comes equipped with an onboard camera and image processing software that can detect a human head in real time and lock the trigger. It also issues an alert if the weapon is pointed at someone's head. The weapons camera can also record images taken during firing, which the company said could provide important material for use in after-action reviews or investigations. A little bit about the weapon. The battery lasts up to 12 hours, depending on usage, but an external power pack can also be added if needed. And I know that sometimes these stories come up and they seem like, you know, part of a dystopian nightmare. But I do, in general, like the idea of smarter weapons, wholly, both lethal and non-lethal. And I know that we've seen huge pushback when it comes to smarter weapons in lethal firearms. Maybe if we could get them a little bit smarter in the non-lethal, maybe that could creep up into the other category. That was my wishful thinking for this story.
You think maybe it'll just creep in?
Just a little design creep into, you know, biometrics and 3D or facial recognition.
Maybe. I don't know. I had some mixed feelings about this. I don't, you know, it. Having not seen it in the real world, I don't know exactly how I feel about this. Here's what I tried to consider, I guess. I realized that we already have the taser, mm-hmm. but I think that's an option that could use a competitor, considering all the blowback for how it's been used, incidents where it's been lethal. Yeah. Amnesty International calls it inhumane. So, you know, I guess what I'd like to know, so sometimes people have died from multiple shocks from a taser.
Mm-hmm.
And it's often been people who were, you know, under the influence of drugs, mentally ill, resisting. I think these are factors that will continue to exist with the 303T's use. And so I think it's important to know how it performs in these real world scenarios, because I think it's one thing to offer evidence of its efficacy in a lab or in, you know, the abstract.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, are people being hit with these multiple times? And like, what happens then?
Yeah.
Are people with compromised health being hit with these, who are maybe more susceptible to negative outcomes in general?
I definitely think so, because I mean, if they're going to equate it to a baton strike, there are people who, when struck by a baton, are going to have a negative outcome.
Definitely. And I also think that, I guess I take a little bit of issue with how these are being promoted for scenarios that are potentially as benign as crowd control, general patrols. Like, these are not scenarios typically that require use of force to begin with. So is it adding to the use of force, or is it taking away? I don't know. It's hard to see that for sure.
No, that's definitely a larger issue as to, like, does that escalate the situation just by its presence?
Right. I agree. I think that's something that needs to be considered. I don't know if that's the case. It just, you know, as an officer, you're not typically using a gun in that scenario anyway.
Yeah.
So I think ultimately it's good that when there are new and innovative ways to make certain police actions less lethal, of course, right? But I'd like to know more, I think, before I get behind it. It may be hard to see how it functions in the real world without letting it function in the real world and seeing what happens. But I think there, you know, I do have a few concerns.
I mean, in warranted concerns with any tactical weapon.
Yeah.
One thing that you mentioned is on patrols, and it made me think of the design, right? Like, this was clearly a design that, if they're carrying that around on a patrol, like, that's something that if I see an officer carrying, I'm like, he's not messing around.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I thought, though, was when you looked at it, did it look like a toy to you guys?
It looks like a toy. It looks like, yeah, like a Nerf toy.
Yeah, like, in one of the things, like, our childhood was staked in guns that looked, or toys that looked too real, looked too close to real guns. And now, Andy, I feel like we're going the opposite direction, where we have these firearms that are looking more and more like toys. And I feel like it's this weird cross-section as a result of, like, video game culture.
The whole language around less lethal is unsettling to me. It makes it easier to just open fire on a crowd. And it's just like, we, you know, as a society, maybe should not encourage the firing of anything, whether it's more or less likely to kill you, for crowd control or, you know, standard patrol, what have you.
Right.
So, you know, I'm the same way. I was kind of mixed about this. Like, I guess it's good that we're taking steps to try and maim fewer people, but
yeah.
I'd be like, that's not bad, but also, but my discomfort with it is more a discomfort with the broader, I don't know if culture is the right word, but the broader culture of shooting, you know, high speed beanbags at people rather than actual bullets.
Yeah, I think there is something to be said about when you do label something as less lethal or non-lethal, that people maybe feel more empowered to fire it than. But again, there's training, all of that training that goes into that, where that the split second decision as to whether or not you pull that trigger, that hopefully has been designed into training, so that way it doesn't become a thing.
You would hope, but
yeah,
I've also read the news recently, so you never know.
Well, I think it's very crucial to see how this works, and if it is like, or if safer weapon technology can be both proven effective and more widely adopted, like I talked about earlier. We've done a lot of stories on biometric smart guns that do use fingerprints, that use facial recognition, that use DNA in order to be able to use. And I think that there's a lot of opportunity there just when it comes to, let's just say, cracking down on gun violence wholly, you know. But I mean, maybe that's just the optimist in me that thinks like, well, if you make sure that the guy that bought it is the one that can fire it, you know, that's one, at least one, one obstacle that we've knocked down. But I know, again, like the dystopian hopefulness that comes out of this. The other part was that the company also said that the camera can record data like predicted point of impact and muzzle movement. So it can kind of like give you a score on the shooter's weaknesses, which at first I thought was crazy. But then if it comes to training or additional information, I just, you know, if there's going to be a weapon in the field, having as much information as possible surrounding the event would really go a long way rather than just trying to collect everybody's cell phone to get video and photo to try and piece it together.
Yeah, the body cam or what have you.
Yeah.
The cop or the car dash cam, that sort of thing.
Yeah. So I think that if we could get to a place where there are smarter weapons out there, it's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, you know, it's still terrible that it has to exist. But I don't know, a less evil necessity, maybe, maybe, I don't know. Interesting to see where this leads to.
Yeah.
All right. Before we jump into, in case you missed it, we have another word from our sponsor. One of the long-lasting impacts of COVID-19 and the global pandemic it created has been the priority now being placed on long-term, enterprise-wide planning. So listen to Jeff and I talk about it. Oracle NetSuite has a new white paper, The Ultimate Guide to Scenario Planning, strategies and steps that are going to help you de-risk your organization. You can register for it now. Here, Jeff and I chop it up and let us know what you think. Or don't, just download it. It's fine. It's for me, it's for you, it's for everybody. Now let's get into, in case you missed it, the stories that maybe didn't make as big of an impact. No, big impact on the industry. Not as many people read it on the sites. That's it. That's, you know, because you missed it.
Yeah.
Andy, what is your in case you missed it this week?
Well, I'm subbing for Jeff this week, but I wanted to make sure he kind of made it into the podcast. So I saw this story elsewhere, but he also made a point to send it to me for our food manufacturing brand. So the headline we used in the story was researchers evaluate, quote, farm-free food. And there's language in the article itself, which was published by UC Irvine, about eliminating farms altogether. Now, that sounds a little reactionary,
yeah,
which I think is maybe why Jeff sent it to me.
Yeah.
But that's not exactly what the study was looking to do. So what happened was a group of researchers basically sought to evaluate if we could, as a society, could produce dietary fats through chemical processes rather than getting them through crops, mm-hmm. which, of course, require farmland. So instead of using palm oil in processed foods, which, you know, is one of the main culprits of the destruction of rainforests in Southeast Asia, that sort of thing, they would just be made in a plant, mm-hmm. similar to soap or any other sort of industrial process that relies on synthesizing fats. So that, of course, does not sound particularly appetizing.
No.
But these scientists are saying it's basically the same process as photosynthesis. So you're just skipping the plant section of photosynthesis. Mm-hmm. So they're not talking ultimately about eliminating agriculture, but just not depending on agriculture for everything that we eat. And by doing that, by removing those fats from the equation, you have a lot of potentially positive ramifications after that. Less demand for farmland, less demand for farm labor, fewer carbon emissions, less water use, and there's probably a lot more that they probably could get into if they wanted to. So I thought it was actually ended up being pretty interesting. Probably could have used a different headline.
No.
Always a good reminder to read beyond the headline.
It is, I mean, just period in general. Mm-hmm. Always read beyond the headline.
Context is important.
Especially if you plan on, if you have an emotional reaction to a headline, it's particularly important.
That's what it's there
to
for.
To read at least the first paragraph.
Good advice.
Yeah. So this is a great idea. I just think we shouldn't get further away from farm to table. I just don't like the idea of synthetic food, period.
Nobody does.
I understand that it might be a necessary evil. But to me, that's fixing the problem in the opposite direction.
They basically said this is a market for processing companies. So they're more likely to use synthetic fats anyway. So this is kind of maybe a way to kind of cut their supply chain a little bit with some added benefits.
So when there's like the line changeover and they've got to purge a little bit of material because they're done with the soap and they're making butter.
Yes.
Yum. All right. Anna, your thoughts on plastic food?
I was loaded.
Sorry, Anna. You know, this is quite the innovation. Do you see it disrupting the industry?
But maybe long term. I mean, you know, I think Andy's right. I think that this is something that maybe there's like a niche for at this point. I don't think the reality is replacing farms. I think the reality is more along the lines of, can we find a way to not have to source this easily replicated, formula or chemical compound from the rainforest?
Use our farmland for higher value, more efficient products, that sort of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. And I read the press release too when it came in, and I was struck by I don't have a number in front of me, maybe you do, but about the amount of farmland that is needed to fulfill on the current pace of the food industry at this point. And it was just this colossally high number. And, you know, maybe that was...
That's something the food industry is really wrestling with, is they're going to have to get a lot more efficient to properly feed people as we move on in the coming decades. So whether this could be part of that equation, you never know.
Yeah. And so it's like without leveraging all of that land, which I think that there are, there's going to be other demands for some of that land. And then obviously some types of agriculture are very, very hard on the environment as well. So I think, yes, I think maybe for specific applications, yes. I don't think for all food in the entire world, no.
Yeah, I think it's, I hope it becomes an opportunity and not a necessary evil.
They had a little pad of butter melting in a pan for the accompanying photo.
Was that really? That was it?
That was it. That's it.
That's legit.
That's right.
Okay. I mean, see, I'd put that on toast. I'd give it a shot. I mean, I'm not back. It would be one of those things where, like, you would have given me a piece of toast with this butter, and then I would have enjoyed it. And then when you told me, like, you gave me the, when you... sprung the surprise on me, I'd be like, we're not
friends. We made it anymore. In a chemical processing plant.
Well, but I mean, it's not like this is a new concept in the food industry either. Nope. That's what margarine is, like a response to try to use more corn. And I don't know. It's just the food industry does this stuff. Mm-hmm.
Yes. All right. In case you missed it this week, is about 3M. And it's a story that was missed by some, but not as many as I thought, because Google Analytics G4 is a dumpster fire right now. Just put that out there. All right. So my story is 3M knew its process was dangerous before a fatal accident. And this is according to OSHA. In February 2022, a 63-year-old worker was killed at a 3M plant in Alexandria, Minnesota. The worker became entangled with a machine during an overnight shift. A few months after the accident, the company assessed its equipment in the U.S. and Canada. According to OSHA, 3M found that powered rollers were hazards in need of safety improvement. Then, in May 2023, just a little over a year later, a worker was helping set up a plastic extrusion line at 3M's manufacturing plant in Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin. The worker died after becoming caught in the machine's rotating rollers. According to OSHA, the death could have been avoided if the company not only followed federal workplace safety standards, but also heeded its own advice. The safety agency assessed $312,000 in proposed penalties for two willful safety violations. I picked this story in particular because, one, I was shocked that something like this, sometimes these stories can still be shocking to you. Like a lot of the things, how it happened, how something like this could happen at a 3M plant, where you think a company like 3M would be the gold standard when it came to safety, just because 3M is sort of like a universal brand associated with safety. And so it also was a reminder that, like, you know, this happens at every level where some people identify a problem and don't fix it right away, and more problems happen as a result. And so when you find them internally, you've got to figure out a solution and fix the problem. I don't know, Anna, if you had a chance to read this story, but I don't know. I found it very surprising that almost the identical incident happens within a year.
Yeah, it's pretty heart-wrenching story to imagine these folks, what they went through, and then their families. It just a horrible scenario. I know what you mean about you think these brands that are so strong that they must have it all under control because everyone knows them, and how could they not? You know, it's not like they're hiding behind anything. They're very well known.
Yeah.
But, I mean, 3M and the name of safety, they're being sued right now for willfully, allegedly, continuing to sell a product to the U.S. military that was not functional, and people's hearing got damaged. And so it's like you kind of never know what's going on behind closed doors. And unfortunately, that was the case here, I guess.
Well, and the difference between those two stories for me is that was 3M, but that was via acquisition. And I understand that's no excuse. It's no excuse. But like, that was the only separation that I had there.
That they didn't originally design it.
Correct.
But they did sell it.
Yes.
Knowing. Yeah. That's
still bad.
That's the allegation. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Allegedly.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. Yeah.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. So, Andy, other problems were found at this plant, right? Mm-hmm. Workers were allowed to circumvent machine guarding to cut and remove wrapped fibers from rotating power rollers and remove fibers from the floor while they were underneath machines or exposed to other cotton hazards. I did want to put this out there that we did reach out to 3M, and to 3M's credit, they got back to me right away. One of the things I wanted to pull out was this quote. They said, "Over the last 6 months, we have worked closely with federal workplace safety and health regulators in connection with their inspection of our Prairie du Chien work site. In addition, 3M has continued to implement improvements and investments to help prevent similar incidents in the future and communicated these improvements to our employees at the work site." Mm-hmm. So I thought it was also important to share that it seems like 3M is working in good faith with OSHA to make sure it doesn't happen again. But I still go back to the original part where they did the internal investigation after the original accident.
I don't know what, and I'm not in a position to say what a practical time is to overhaul the safety of these machines for a big company like this that has 40 plants, whatever. Yeah, I don't know what the time frame is.
Yeah.
But it's clearly not, you know, 6 months or however long it was between when they did the assessment and then when this second incident occurred. I don't know. I mean, I just, it's, the statement talks about the Prairie du Chien work site, and I just can't help in the back of my head wonder if other plants still have this issue going on right now.
Yeah. Right? Well, and I understand when it comes to, I mean, when you are as big as 3M, like trying to fix every machine everywhere would be difficult. But I think that when it comes to machine guarding, I mean, I don't feel like some of the solutions out there, Anna, are that difficult to implement when it comes to machine guarding.
Right.
But I don't know. I don't know. So at least it seems like they're trying to improve going forward, and hopefully we don't see another accident coming out of those facilities. Anna, what's your In Case You Missed It this week?
The story I selected was titled GM and Stellantis Invest $33 million in a Company Making Magnets Without Rare Earth Metals. So I think we talk so often about how these auto companies need to address the raw material problem that's coming hard and fast. Well, here's one solution potentially. So Niron Magnetics of Minneapolis says that it can build permanent magnets by using iron nitride, which is abundant and inexpensive compared with rare earth minerals, and GM and Stellantis are among its investors. GM said the companies will co-develop EV magnet motor technology. Kai Daniels, supervising principal of GM Investments, said the investment will help GM locate its EV supply chain in North America, a key component to make vehicles eligible for U.S. federal tax credits. So there's a, you know, there's a business component as well there. Niron Magnetics CEO Jonathan Rowntree said that testing shows that the company's magnets work, and the agreement with GM will help the company start large-scale manufacturing. The magnets are not just for auto. They can be used in consumer electronics, industrial motors, pumps, compressors, wind turbines, and other products. So really anything that you would use rare earth in now, it sounds like you could use this also. So, you know, looking at the materials conundrum, this has been one reason that the EV transition has been super costly for automakers. But once somebody hits on something where they can shift the trajectory of the supply chain, potentially, they will really have a competitive advantage here. Oh, so you can see why this is appealing, right? There are a lot of problematic elements with rare earths, supply chains that are globally remote, scarcity issues, issues with human cost associated with related conflicts therein. So, and right now, China accounts for 92% of rare earth magnet production. That is not a safe place for automotive to be.
Right.
And this addresses that. So, you know, every time I see a story like this, I just think like we talk about like all the problems to solve with the EV transition. Well, they're working on it. They got a lot of irons in the fire, and this is one.
They are working on it. And while it seems like we have essentially, for the first generation of electric vehicles, it seems like we've picked the winners, right? We picked the vehicle design, we picked the battery design in terms of how we're going forward with the first generation. But can you imagine what like the third or fourth is going to look like? It's going to be completely different. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and this is where Jeff would chime in about like, well, don't forget hydrogen. You never know. You never know.
You never know.
But no, I always enjoy these stories just because it is, you know, a cool new technology. And when you have companies like GM and Ford or Stellantis kind of putting their money where their mouth is, you know, that's a big bet. Like part of a $33 million investment that'll go a long way to giving Neuron.
Yeah. And they're ready for production. It sounds like this is what that money is for, is actually manufacturing.
If it pays off, I mean, not only do these companies stand to benefit, but I mean, this is the whole, that alters the trajectory of the whole energy economy.
Totally. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, great pick, Anna.
Thanks. I wish I had written it. Thanks, Associated Press. You're really doing good work out there.
Well, before we move on to our final thoughts, we have our contest is back. We're doing another giveaway, and we have a new giveaway thanks to our friends at Sellers. So, founded in 1985 and headquartered in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Sellers is a leading manufacturer of shop towels, multi-use disposable wipers, towels and tissues, absorbent products. Sellers products, which are sold under, you might know them as the Toolbox or the Clean Task and Mayfair brands, they're made from recycled and renewable materials. They're high performance and good for the environment. Sellers is committed to using sustainable practices in all business areas while serving our people, customers, and the planet. Now, how this relationship came up was Sellers sent Anna, Jeff, and myself a tumbler, like a mug, a coffee mug, and it was great. And they also sent this like baggie of towels, like because they were going to be at a trade show, and they're like, hey, bring this mug and baggie of towels, and we want to talk more about towels when we get to the trade show. Well, unfortunately, we weren't going to make the trade show, but I wanted to reach out and just say thanks. And I'm like, hey, we also, you know, have the Today in Manufacturing podcast, and this would make a great giveaway. And they said yes. So basically, they not only want to give the winner of this contest the tumbler that we received, and I forgot to bring today, but I remember the towels. They're also going to give a white rags box and a shop towels box. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, like if you just look it up, you see that they're in every shop. You see these everywhere.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Like my dad has them in his shop. So I don't think he can win though. Sorry, Pop. We just wanted to start simple. Like, so email us. We want to know what was the worst spill or mess that you've ever had to clean up at work. So email myself, Andy, Jeff, or Anna the worst mess you ever had to clean up. And it doesn't necessarily have to be towel related. Okay. I just want to know how you clean it up. What do you think?
Yeah, I like it.
Should it be strictly wiped mess? Or I say universally.
I don't, yeah, I think the door's open for how, I don't, maybe you had to use a vacuum. Maybe you had to use a shop vac. I would like to know what this mess was.
Do we
have
like a strict scientific judging criteria for the biggest mess?
Yes, absolutely. The four of us vote on it, and then one wins.
That is scientific.
Yeah. The messier, the better. Or actually, I don't know. Maybe you just got really creative about how you had to clean it up, or maybe it was something truly unique that you had to clean up. I want to know. Anyway, so thanks again to Sellers for providing this. We're going to be doing this giveaway for a bit. So remember to email Andy, Jeff, David, or Anna at IN.com with the worst spiller mess you ever had to clean up at work, and we'll see who the first winner of the tumbler, white rags box, and shop towels box.
Can we even put like contest or something in the subject line, or podcast contest or Sellers contest or something? I get a lot of emails. I don't want to miss it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like biggest mess.
There you go.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Biggest mess. Yeah, that's a good one.
That's a good, I'll hit that one for sure.
Just like, what a mess. All right. Final thoughts this week. Andy, I'll start with you. What's your final thought this week?
Do you guys remember, I thought of this because of the dime heist story. You guys remember early in the pandemic and there was supposedly a run on coins?
Yeah, the coin shortage, yes.
Yeah, there's a shortage of everything at some point, and well, I remember the coin shortage, yes.
Well, yeah. So I had a big plastic stein from a baseball game giveaway of coins collected over, you know, 10 years, whatever it is. And I was like, I'll do my part. I will bring that in to the bank with my mask on and have them counted up, and it can help out the broader economy. And now almost 4 years later, it's still sitting in my room completely full.
You didn't do it?
I slipped my mind. I had a lot of stuff going on.
Please like, tell me you at least rationed.
I wasn't like demand. I was, you know, everybody was cashless. Yeah. I wasn't demanding coins from everyone I was doing business
Keep
with
the
at
change.
The time.
Pay me
yeah.
change. Yeah. Pay me in change.
Yeah. Some banks don't take them anymore.
No, I mean, producer Alex made a really good point. Some banks don't take coins anymore. Or
man, that's legal tender. What do you mean the banks don't take
sometimes
them?
Sometimes
like
you walk.
You have a, like a full jug of coins.
Yeah, they won't take the full jug.
Go to the quick store.
No, they tell you to go to a Coinstar, or my old bank would give you the wraps. Like, they would give you the coin wraps, and like, you got to wrap them yourself and bring them in. I'm like, I'm not going to do that. And
what
for
is this
mild
bank,
inconvenience,
David?
It was Wells Fargo.
Chase.
Yeah, Wells Fargo. Chase doesn't do it. We're like, they were just like, you got to wrap your own. I'm like, well, then I'm going to leave the entire bank, and it has nothing to do with my other problems here.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that this was going to be like you cashed them in at the height of it and they gave you like an extra 20% down.
Give me a gold star.
Yeah.
Nope.
Still
in my room.
Closet.
Yep.
I will say like I did have a coin collection. I cashed it in before the coin shortage, but it was one of those where like it kind of sneaks up on you.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just like, whoa, had that in my closet, huh? All right. Probably could have used that money better. And once I cashed it in, I'm certain we didn't.
Yeah, you know, with inflation, it's probably worth very little now.
Probably, which is fine.
What did we ever get to the bottom of the coin shortage? Like, what caused that? I don't understand it because, like,
I feel like I knew at the time, but now it's I have no idea.
Like, I didn't understand just because, like, no one was using.
Yeah,
like,
nobody was paying using physical currency anymore.
Yeah,
I don't know.
But then wouldn't you just get, like, the stores would just, like, keep theirs then?
That's what
you know, like, I don't, it doesn't.
It doesn't make sense to me because I remember, like, Woodman's being like, hey, if you pay in cash, we might not be able to give you exact change. I'm just like, that seems odd to me. You know, you got a lot of balls in the air financially. I feel like you should be able to have pennies.
Yeah.
Someone Google great coin shortage of 2001.
And how Andy's all caused it.
Yep.
I don't have anything too crazy for my final thought this week. It's just more of like an old dadism. So one of my old dadisms is that my favorite part of the grocery store, and I may have shared this on the podcast, my favorite part of the grocery store is the clearance aisle where everything's cleared out and marked down. Because I feel like it's a easy way to try new products or things that I normally wouldn't or that are maybe too expensive. You know, that have just been like run over by a fork truck and marked down so I can try like a Kind bar. But so I had a find in this clearance section that is like my new favorite thing in the world and I have to share it. And I brought some into the office. I don't know if it was when you were gone, but they are called Mighty Lil Crunchy Corn and they were manufactured by Sea Point Farms. And
Mighty Lil Crunchy Corn?
Mighty Lil. I mean, maybe.
Is it for kids?
You know, I got it because I thought it would be a good snack for the kids. And they kind of like pitch it is this hybrid between it's like better than popcorn and it's not as hard as what's the corn?
Corn nuts.
Corn nuts. Every time. Mm-hmm. Every time. And I was just like, okay, this will be like, this will break my teeth and I'll regret this.
Mm-hmm.
But no, it is delicious and it is truly better than popcorn. And it's like so I liked it so much that I went back and it was all still there and clears and I like bought every bag. I'm not even joking. I went back one more time and they had another one on the shelf and I'm like, that is mine.
It was good. Yeah. The better than popcorn claim is a little absurd, but it was good.
Yeah. I mean, hey, they got to market it. I'm just hoping that it was like in this section of the grocery store because it was sent there and they didn't cover like carry it. And not that like I'd miss the boat and they're just like, you know what? There's not a market for this.
I was going to ask if you were a little concerned about the future of that product, given that it was in the broader consumer looked at it and said,
yeah,
I don't know.
No, that's the gamble that you take. Like, yeah. I mean, sometimes you all of a sudden like street taco Pringles and then you realize like They get they don't you know, they're completely discontinued.
Did they make street taco Pringles?
Yeah, they're good, man. Oh, same section.
You got my husband hooked on those old Bay Goldfish, and then they he's like, now I can't find them.
No, and then they're gone. It's I mean,
just
it's,
dust the regular Goldfish with Old Bay.
That, I know, that's what I said. I'm like, I could easily make these.
It's like you know, the handshake with the devil that you make when you shop in the clearance section. But if you had the chance to check this out, I know that loyal listener Pete, you know, we were having a cookout the other day, and he was just like, what are these? I'm like, oh, I'm happy to tell you, Pete, and grab a handful. And then we talked about crunchy corn for way too long because we're dads. And like, really, to like carry that thread through different kid conversations, that's the only one we could get through.
Nice.
So I encourage you to try it and let me know. But they are not for the faint of teeth. Like, you know, you got to go easy.
The initial crunch is a lot to deal with, but they soften up nice after that.
It is. It's like everyone experienced.
It's not like corn nuts.
No, no, no. But it's like, it was like everyone took a handful and like ate it. And then I was like, oh. And then it was just like, you know, like, I'll come back. I'll come back at you. And
well,
sorry to send you. Oh, my goodness. You're okay. On the website.
I'm in. Yeah. I first, I just want to tell you, and this is not good news.
Oh, no.
I'm on Sea Point Farms website,
no.
And I am not seeing Mighty Little Crunchy Corn anywhere. I'm seeing Mighty Little Lentils.
No. No, it's over. Oh, my goodness. And I've just been eating them like I'd be able to get them no matter what. And now they're gone.
I bet the little lentils are good.
I mean, I guess I got to shift. I got to pivot to Crunchy Little Edamame.
Yeah, they
or
have
seaweed crisps. I can't go there.
Organic edamame pasta.
Well, oh, you know what? I got to get a line into the company and just be like, you know, I'm really interested in learning more about how this is manufactured. Maybe send me everything you have.
Yeah,
in your
maybe
inventory.
They got stuff in the warehouse.
Oh no, I've got to hit. I mean, I guess that means I got to hit every grocery store in that chain in the area. It's the only thing that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, you're in trouble, man. There's this product is being discontinued, I think.
Oh, hoarding. Anna, what is your final thought this week?
Okay, so real quick, I wanted to mention that. So Jeff had asked last week about people's candy that they would avoid around Halloween time.
Bad candy.
And
candy
I did
corn shade.
I did get a note from Marina who said that the candy that she avoids is Tootsie Rolls, candy corn, and Jujubes because it gets stuck in your teeth, which I fair.
Yeah.
Dots, that's another one. She didn't say dots, but I would like to add that.
Is it like a bad candy? I thought you liked dots.
I do like dots, but they get stuck in your teeth. So you have to be like very strategic about when you can eat those.
Okay.
And then she said, unpopular opinion, but I love getting the Mounds or Almond Joy candy. And to that I say, yes, I agree with you.
Yeah, that's fine.
Those are my favorite ones.
I did not like Mounds bars until I started shopping at the Mounds Pet Warehouse, and they give you the novelty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Don't forget your free Mounds candy bar.
And then you started liking them?
And then, like, and so I just, like, they handed me one.
Turn down free chocolate.
No, they would hand you one every time, and I was just like, okay, well, thanks. I just dropped $100 on dog food. Thanks for the fun-size candy bar. And then I would eat it, and I'm like, this is delicious.
Such a delight.
They got me.
They really are.
Yeah.
But what I wanted to tell you guys is the biggest mess that I've ever cleaned up at my house because that made me think of it. And well, obviously I have three kids, so probably not the biggest mess I've cleaned up.
Hopefully not too recently.
One of the most memorable. opening the fridge door and accidentally tipping out a full bottle of maple syrup onto the floor. The bottom shoots off.
Yeah.
Maple syrup. It like, for how slow you think maple syrup moves?
No, it doesn't because it's like, it's liquidy.
Just like immediately, like slime, just slimed my whole floor.
Slow onto the pancakes, fast everywhere else.
Oh, yeah.
Under the fridge, like it was, yeah, it was the worst. So,
is it like one of those where you still catch a sticky spot and you're like, I'm never going to get it all out?
It was definitely like, there was days of that. I just had to go over it and over and over again. It was bad. I don't know. There might still be some under the fridge. I don't really know. It's kind of one of those built-in ones.
Yeah, you know, like where you bring it up for the annual cleaning, the annual vacuuming and everything. Like for me, it used to be when it got dirty enough under there that it stopped making ice. I'm like, okay, all right.
Or probably time.
Yep. Yeah. Well, I also wanted to say when we're doing shout-outs, I want to send a shout-out to Joe, who sent us the koozie in action, drinking out of the Today in Manufacturing koozie while playing Cruisin' USA.
Awesome.
Incredible. Yeah. And just very jealous.
That's
jealous.
That's a weekend. Holy smokes.
I know. It's just the cool. It's got, like, I saw 1/20th of his basement, and I'm just like, you're already way cooler than me.
Oh, he had it in his basement?
Yeah.
Come on.
Oh, yeah, no, he wasn't like out and about at a cruise in
USA. Like a skate land playing the arcade. Yeah. With his koozie.
Just like, sir, you can't bring your own koozie in here, man. Like, all right. Well, thank you, Joe, for sending that in as well, and thank you, Marina. Before we get out of here, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You can also help us out a lot by emailing podcast. You can also help us out a lot by leaving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use. If you want to email the podcast, you can reach any of us at Andy, Jeff, David, or Anna at IN.com with email the podcast in the subject line or biggest mess in the subject line, however you want to work that. You can also subscribe to our daily newsletter. Make sure you get it delivered to your inbox first and subscribe to us on YouTube at IN Magazine so you can join us live every Thursday, depending on if everything works, to have rework, depending on whether or not I'm late, let's be honest.
It's depending on whether or not I'm running late. Yeah, we got Thanksgiving coming up, you guys.
Yeah.
Two Thursdays away.
I know. We're going to have the rare Wednesday podcast where we have like 10 collective stories to analyze like across all our websites and just like, this one's clearly the most important. It's like, no, it's not. It's just the only one that came out.
That Wednesday before Thanksgiving is always very good for people's mental faculties.
Yeah, we'll have to record that one real early. Mm-hmm. Like at 9 a.m.
9 a.m.er.
All right. Well, my name is David Manti. For Andy Zell and Anna Wells and Jeff Ranke, hope to see you again soon and have fun out at Rockwell. This is the Today in Manufacturing podcast, and we'll see you next week.